Good morning. Welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO in Portland. This is Norm Diamond. Our producer this morning is Patricia Colburn. Today is September 11th, known more familiarly to Americans as 9/11, a day that, as a former president said about Pearl Harbor, a day that shall live in infamy. But which 9/11 shall we talk about, and whom do we mean by Americans? Before there was 9/11 in 2001 in the United States, there was 9/11 1973, 50 years ago today, in Chile, the military coup that overthrew the democratically elected government of President Salvador Allende. There'll be lots of remembrances today in the U.S. about the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. I'm not sure what new there is to say about it. Our focus will be on the coup in Chile, how its consequences continue to reverberate throughout the Americas, and on the role of the U.S. government in that destruction of a democratic regime. Before getting into the program, I want to remind you that KBOO is a volunteer-powered community platform. That means the station is able to broadcast because it's funded by you, the listener. If you're able, please support the station by making a contribution today. Or better yet, becoming a monthly sustaining member. Just go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44-321. On today's program, I'll talk with Christian Araus, co-chair for the Americas of DSA's International Committee, about that history and present-day Chile. Desiree Hellegers will bring us the music of Victor Jara, the wonderful folk singer, part of the popular movement that brought Allende to the presidency. Matt Witt will review The Five Wounds, a recent novel by Kirsten Valdez Quaid. And we'll take a brief look back at another significant historical event, the anniversary of which we recently commemorated. The end of August marked 60 years from the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Our theme for today comes from a mural seen this week in Santiago, Chile's capital city. It's a painting of Victor Jara with the words, "Danos tu fuerza y tu valor al combatir." Give us your strength and courage to fight. To start us off, I'd like to play you some other Chile-related music. This is from a Bay Area group called Quijere Ma, led by a man who now calls himself Quique Cruz. Cruz was born in Chile and jailed under the military dictatorship that followed the coup. This piece is from a suite Quijere Ma performed for a documentary film on Pablo Neruda. Neruda, of course, was the world-renowned Chilean poet and member of the Communist Party there, who himself once ran for the presidency. His death was a mystery for many years. It's now clear from forensic evidence that the dictatorship had him killed on the operating table just a few days after the coup. If we have time, I'll read you some of his poetry. But I also have to acknowledge that he's fallen out of favor in Chile now, as feminist sensibilities enable a critical look at his relations with women and in his own family. From the suite, Tinta Verde, which they translate as Green Blues, here's a bit of Quijere Ma's haunting Isla Negra. Isla Negra was the name Neruda gave his windswept home with the crashing Pacific waves where he liked to write. Yeah. Isla Negra by Quijote Ma. Christian Arauz is a careful observer of contemporary Chile. Here I ask him also to fill us in on some of the consequential history. Some of that history is embodied in two quotes from high U.S. government officials, from National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Henry Kissinger: "I don't see why we need to stand by and watch a country go communist due to the irresponsibility of its people. The issues are much too important for the Chilean voters to be left to decide to themselves." And from President Nixon, giving covert directives to his operatives: "Make the Chilean economy scream." This is Norm Diamond. I'm speaking this morning with Christian Arauz. Christian is the co-chair for the Americas of DSA, of the Democratic Socialists of America. Welcome this morning to the Old Mole Variety Hour, Christian.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
Very glad to have you. I should add that you come as well from Chilean extraction.
Yes, my parents migrated in the 80s when they were young. I've been in New York my whole life, but definitely had my heart and intellectual curiosity with Chile and my taste as well.
Well, let's begin with Chile today. We're going to end up focusing on 50 years ago and the coup against Allende. But that coup resonates still. It does around the world, and it does specifically in Chile. Let's talk about both those aspects.
Right. I think to start with the world and, you know, the United States as well, and a lot of Western society, with the concerns over the strength of democracy at the moment. We've seen plenty of talk of threats, militarized threats, fascistic threats to democracy, to constitutional rule of order, emerge in the past few years. And I think that motivates some of the sentiment towards commemorating the coup. I think that was where it resonated, especially in North America and the U.S. and Canada in particular. And for the diaspora, it's a mix of that and the personal history of the coup, and knowing especially if you're of a left or social democratic persuasion, it's probably the most formative event of political consciousness for so many people. And I think that also expands to North Americans of any leftist. It's an extremely formative event for the U.S.'s role in it, the transnational corporation role in it, and broader Western countries' support for either, you know, expanding not just to the U.K., but West Germany as well played a part. Brazil played a part in supporting the overthrow of Salvador Allende. I think it's a completely different matter when you domestically within Chile, though, because of a variety of factors. We have a broad idea of how much of the fact that there was foreign influence in the coup, there was domestic factors as well, but the exact details, the exact portionment is still very much a hot debate. And because of that murkiness, it's easy for the right to obstinate, deny, be contradictory, or just justify the coup. Just in the past week, there's been various stances from right-wing figures who refused to sign on to President Boric's declaration to commemorate the coup, to vow for it to never happen again. Eventually, former President Sebastián Piñera signed the declaration, but he's not going to participate in the commemoration ceremonies proper. The far-right party also is just not going to participate in it at all. We probably will see them celebrate or post some laudatory remarks on that day.
Laudatory about Pinochet or about the the fact of the coup in favor of
Ex
it.
exactly. Last during the last presidential campaign, the right-wing candidate said this was the day Chile chose liberty. So that'll be the type of sentiment you'll see from right-wing circles that day.
So still controversial, still alive in Chile. Your assessment about kind of the world reaction, I want to add something to it. You gave a very modest assessment, actually, about the significance. There's another dimension, and that's not just about the challenge to democracy or the challenge of authoritarian regimes that, of course, we're all facing in the world now, but Allende stood for something else beyond that, and that was there a peaceful path to socialism? And I certainly remember the controversies at the time. Was that even possible? And of course, the coup against Allende seemed to be an argument that that chosen path was an extremely difficult one, if possible at all.
So when we look at the 50s, 60s, 70s, that mid 20th century where armed struggle managed to preserve socialism in Latin America, in Cuba, Nicaragua, what have you, and electoral peaceful paths were crushed brutally, with the help of the United States, of course. I think we're starting to see that flip where now there's a consensus for peaceful struggle within the contours of democracy. There's not really a large appetite and interest for the vanguardian armed struggle as a means for securing change. That's a long debate to have and why that factors have changed. But certainly, I think in terms of Allende's legacy, it serves as a forerunner, really, to this sort of mass struggle for social democracy that now you've seen his successors in Chile, Brazil, and elsewhere build upon, and seek to preserve. So Allende was really just the first of his kind, and I guess that's how his legacy perseveres.
Now, I would argue that Allende's objectives probably went beyond the kinds of objectives, the kinds of policies, certainly the kinds of accomplishments that we're seeing from those who followed his path. So let's go back 50 years and talk about what Allende, who he was, what he was after, and what he actually did accomplish in the 3 years that he held the presidency. And of course, we're not talking just about one person. We're talking about a movement that he was part of and led.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in his early life, he was a physician by trade. And as a student, he was elected vice president of the University Student Federation. It's the same body that exists. It's been around for over 100 years. It elected Gabriel Boric, its president, a decade ago. It's elected Camila Vallejo, who's now a senior minister in the government. So it's an institution, a legacy institution for socialists, the student movement that encompasses generations. Allende co-founded the Socialist Party when he started as a deputy, built himself on workplace reforms, childcare initiatives, and all this is built upon his path as president. He supported nationalization. He expanded nationalization to the US-owned copper mines. And to this day, despite the dictatorship, despite the return of democracy and everything, Chile still has nationalized copper. And he expanded also to privately owned coal mines as well. And using that, he funded initiatives that helped ch child development. Free milk distribution is probably the most noteworthy, and an overall expansion of the social safety net. He also expanded land reform and eliminated the feudal land policies that governed rural Chile. And as a result, landowners no longer had free labor from tenant farmers. That vestige of colonial Spain it was eliminated once and for all. And to harken back to that connection with the student movement, he also expanded co-governance in universities and gave students greater power over education policy. And we all know that all these accomplishments were despite pressure and the asymmetric warfare that the Nixon administration launched, and from sabotage from the upper classes within Chile as well.
One of the reforms, one of the accomplishments that always stood out for me was building vacation facilities for workers on the coast, taking kind of prime coastal real estate and building cabins for just ordinary workers to have access to on their vacation.
It was, yeah, all these little things that Allende's career around, especially workers, workplace reform, work life, was so critical for him to build that popular support. And it's, like I mentioned, it encompassed every facet from their vacation time to their safety within the workplace, child labor, all these components that, we in the US just fought and struggled for 100, 110, 120 years ago. It took until the mid 20th century for countries in Latin America like Chile to implement and expand upon.
Many of which we do not have still.
Exactly, yeah.
I mean, the program for that you mentioned, milk for every kid in the country. That's something that's sorely needed here. We don't have that.
No,
Healthcare for all, etc.
when he was a deputy, Allende was one of the drafters for universal health care. And even now there is still a state provider of health care in Chile. It's forced to share space with private insurance companies, but at the same time, though, that private marketplace actually a bit of a proto Obamacare format of what was built in after Allende's removal still exists, but also that state healthcare is still there and has the potential to outlast the private marketplace, given some current situations going on with Chile's healthcare sector. All these little initiatives that he made that the dictatorship and neoliberalism sought to snuff out still managed to survive in some way to be built upon.
Okay, this is a brief period in, I don't want to say in power because we want to talk about the forces opposing him too and what he wasn't able to accomplish. But let's start out. How was it possible for him even to win, to get to that position? And what were the forces behind him? And what were the forces opposing him?
Well, it took persistence. This was his fourth presidential campaign in 1970 that he finally won. And like in his previous campaigns, he was the unquestioned candidate of popular unity, which was the coalition of communists, socialists, and Christian leftists as well. This is where you're starting to see obviously in the 80s, you'd see liberation theology be a key component in Central America. It did exist in Chile in the 60s and 70s as well. And in terms of makeup, demographically, we're looking at young adult professionals, students, trade unionists, rural land workers, really. And in an election in 1970, he lost the largest urban cities, Santiago, Valparaíso, but he still collected enough support within from those young urban workers and students to not lose by that much, despite the more popular support that other candidates received from older and wealthier residents. And then he just swept up smaller cities in rural Chile. And in that era, this was a first past the post election. So with three candidates that all received, at least 30% of the votes, and they only won the overall vote of 36%. In that constitution, how it went was the top two candidates who, if no one failed to reach a majority, the Congress was to decide between the two candidates that got the most votes. So it was him and the right-wing candidate Jorge Alessandri. And the norm was for Congress to follow the vote that the people had made. They ended up doing that in Allende's case, but during the interim, this is where you saw the Nixon administration begin its campaign against Chile. The first thing was to pressure Congress into not ratifying the vote, and straight from the onset begin plans for a coup. And this is the story of René Schneider's death, his attempted kidnapping and murder. And it was because, just for a brief bio, he was the head of Chile's armed forces and was also an avowed constitutionalist. He was not going to break the constitution for personal gain. After his death, it was untenable for the Congress, for the right, to not vote for Allende. The whole incident surrounding his attempted kidnapping and murder was shocked Chile. And
I did not realize that there were good consequences coming out. I mean, we knew that Schneider was a supporter of the constitutional process, and that the military therefore would have backed the chosen candidate. And so it seemed like his assassination, Schneider's assassination, was a step backward. But you're saying that that's part of what enabled the Congress, part of what forced the Congress to select Allende as the president.
That, and also Allende struck a deal with the Christian Democrats to, as his own constitutional protection pledge. Allende did get some criticism for compromising with the Christian Democrats, but at the same time, it was enough to secure his support. And with the events of Schneider's death and the agreement, it was enough for him to receive the ratification comfortably. So it was a combination of politics and the events kind of diffusing what could have been, you know, a thwarted attempt for him to even be inaugurated, let alone hold power.
Okay, forces opposing Allende.
Your traditional wealthy elites, for sure, especially domestically. There was probably the most noteworthy that stood out, especially in this week while in Chile. There's been events commemorating the coup, a lot of news programs, etc. The owner of El Mercurio, one of the largest newspapers, was a key liaison, especially in the period we're just talking about here, after Allende's the vote for Allende in September of 1970 and the ratification in October. The owner of El Mercurio was a key liaison between Washington and domestic forces in Chile. And from that also started the business class resistance. And with that came funding for militant far-right extremists through that network domestically. Obviously, Allende was also not popular with the Catholic Church as well, especially for the attempt for land reform, so landowners as well. So it was a genuine class construction. And then also there was moderates who were concerned about socialism gaining hold, but were at least enough of them from 1964 to 1970 either sided with Allende or were muted overall, or were satisfied with Allende willing to compromise with the Christian Democrats to support. But, you know, we're talking about just your moderate voter who's pro-social reforms, saw some of the nationalization already taking place before 1970, but just didn't want to go completely all the way with an open Marxist. But that's the broad contour from your moderate to your extreme opposition for Allende.
Domestically. And then, yes, of course, we've got AT&T, big U.S. conglomerate. And elsewhere in the program, I will give the exact quote, but I can't resist the famous Henry Kissinger quotation about how the people of Chile cannot be allowed democratically to vote what they think is in their own best interest. It's better the way he said it. But
the documents from the National Security Archive are especially revealing of Kissinger's nature with regards to Chile, especially condescending. Obviously, Nixon's reputation for his temperament was noteworthy, but behind the scenes, It's Kissinger who was chairing the meetings, providing strategic advice, and just plotting the entire time in this, and was really the one who motivated Nixon's reasoning the most in this anti-communist realpolitik that was incredibly cynical. That is, some of this stuff is just starting to come out. There's a documentary that came out last week in Chile that's actually was available to stream anywhere in the world. And it's just pouring through the documents from the archive. And this is all you see Kissinger be very, very frank this entire time about wanting to suffocate Chile's democracy straight from the onset, straight from the once the results were known.
And even ahead of time in prior, when Allende was running and losing in prior elections, they saw
Yes.
this moderate socialist, they saw him as somehow the pathway to communism. Not too long ago, I prepared an obituary for Kissinger that I was going to air on the radio, and then I discovered he's still alive. He's about 100 years old. We will deal with him when the inevitable happens. Christian, any last word about today in Chile? As we speak, we're 4 hours different time zone from Chile, so all kinds of events are going on. It's potentially a dangerous day in Chile too. We could get news of strife.
Yeah, it's important to know that because of the fact that it was a the end game of what had been a years long political struggle and internal battle, that the event itself is not going to carry that universal gravity. You know, obviously we sh the date is shared with what happened in the United States in 2001. Where that's kind of a universally felt tragedy in one way or another. People mourn in different ways and understand that something very bad happened to the overall nation on that day. Contrast that in Chile, where there are sectors who are openly going to celebrate this day as something an unmitigated good for Chile, and others who are affected by the tragedy, who either sentimentally or who ended up losing people in the violence that followed or in the dictatorship that followed. So we should always be aware that this is going to be, that there may be strife, there may be hot debate. And also at the same time, this is a country that right now is struggling to avoid an economic recession. It has unemployment problems. It has a whole slew of issues surrounding its major sectors across the entire country. So for people who maybe were not around in 1973, you know, this is just their lives are right now what's more important. So the anniversary and the events just kind of linger in the background or something that can be tuned out, as is often the case here as well. I mean, there's people I'm sure who don't feel inclined to participate in commemorations of 2001. So it's a very similar dynamic going on. And it's been a problem for the government because the for people who are too young, you know, ritual ceremonies aren't the thing that's going to motivate them. But at the same time, it's an incredibly important thing to have the state commemorate the event and have it be the official position of the state that this was an anti-democratic tragedy that occurred.
As you began our conversation by pointing out, not just what it represents historically, the coup against Allende, but the way in which it continues to structure possibilities. Yeah, within Chile, it continues to resonate in very concrete kinds of ways as well, and including in programs that continue and social divisions that continue. Christian, I want to thank you for being with us this morning. We could talk a lot further, I think, about contemporary Chile. Pay attention to the news. See what happens today. And we'll continue following events in Chile. And very possibly, Christian, talk again.
I would love to. It's been a pleasure.
Good. That was Christian Arauz. This is Norm Diamond for the Old Mole Variety Hour. That was a substantial discussion with Christian Arauz. Even so, we didn't have sufficient time to cover a couple of topics I would have liked. What happened under the 17 years of military rule that followed the coup? How Allende's reforms were crippled? How Chile became the test case and purest example of the neoliberalism that now afflicts the world? The repression and domestic terror that accompanied the economics and were used to maintain control? And another important topic, the role of the left in the coalition that sustained Allende. What their critiques of Allende were, how they pushed him to go further, and whether they were right to do so, or ended up making him and themselves more vulnerable. I do want to mention that old mole Luisa Martinez is in Chile as we speak and will bring us her report on a future Monday morning Old Mole Variety Hour. And now old mole Desiree Heligers draws on a counterpunch essay she wrote, Victor Jara's Hands, an anti-fascist memoir festo and brief personal history of neoliberalism, to remind us of the great folk singer. We'll post a link to the essay when today's program is uploaded to the Old Mole website.
Living in the U.S., you'd never know that Chile had its own national disaster on September 11th, nearly three decades before the U.S. Not many Americans can define neoliberalism, let alone know that on September 11th, 1973, it was ushered into Chile by U.S.-made tanks and at the butt of U.S.-made guns. It was on September 11th, 1973, that Richard Nixon and his henchman, Henry Kissinger, swept Augusto Pinochet to power as the front man for the U.S.-sponsored experiment in neoliberalism. A folk singer-songwriter often referred to as Chile's Bob Dylan, Victor Jara would be the most visible of more than 3,000 Chileans executed by Pinochet's death squad in September as the coup began. You can get a quick overview of the horrors that the U.S. helped unleash on Chileans in the 1970s by watching the 2019 Netflix documentary, Massacre at the Stadium. Shortly after Pinochet's reign of terror began, an estimated 5,000 people were detained at a Santiago stadium, then named Estadio Chile, and since renamed Estadio Victor Jara. And another 20,000 were held at the Estadio Nacional across town. Professors, students, musicians, farm and factory workers were crowded shoulder to shoulder and sorted into lines to live or die, to be interrogated, beaten, tortured, and or murdered. At Estadio Chile, more than 70 were executed on site, while others were disappeared. Today, a quote painted on the back of the Estadio Nacional reads, Un pueblo sin memoria es un pueblo sin futuro. A people without memory are a people without a future. Jara grew up poor in a family of farm workers, but went on to become a theater director and teacher, and to achieve international visibility with songs like Manifesto, which speaks to Jara's understanding of art as a critical tool in struggles for justice, as an instrument of decolonizing resistance, of spiritual, material, and ecological liberation.
Yo no canto por cantar, ni por tener buena voz. Canto porque la guitarra tiene sentido y razón, tiene corazón de tierra y alas de palomita.
I don't sing for the love of singing or because I have a good voice, sang Jara. I sing because my guitar has both feeling and reason. It has a heart of earth and the wings of a dove. Jara's music was inspired by his mother, Amanda Martinez's, love of folk music rooted in her indigenous Mapuche heritage. His music was also shaped by a Catholic education that included a brief period in the seminary. Jara's music was embraced in the 1960s and 70s by American folk heavies like Pete Seeger and Joan Baez. Arlo Guthrie and Holly Near are among the American songwriters who have since written tribute songs. In his song El Derecho de Vivir en Paz, or The Right to Live in Peace, released on his 1971 album, Jara spoke to the catastrophic effects of the U.S. aerial bombardment of Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia. El derecho de vivir en paz. Indochina es el lugar más allá del ancho mar donde revientan la flor con genocidio y napalm. La luna es una explosión que funde todo el clamor, el derecho de vivir en paz. Indochina is the place, far beyond the wide sea, where the flower bursts with genocide and napalm. The moon is an explosion that melts all the clamor. The right to live in peace. In the run-up to the election of Allende, Jara's version of the song Venceremos, or We Will Overcome, became the anthem of Allende's Popular Unity Coalition. From the deep crucible of the homeland, the people's voices rise up. The new day comes from over the horizon. All Chile breaks out in song. The song also figured centrally in popular accounts of Jara's death. Pinochet's U.S.-supported forces beat and tortured him, smashing his wrists and mutilating his hands before executing him. At some point in the stadium, Jara reportedly sang Venceremos to the other prisoners to give them courage. Before he was executed, shot more than 40 times by Pinochet's U.S.-funded forces, Jara wrote his final song. What horror the face of fascism creates. They carry out their plans with knife-like precision. Nothing matters to them. To them, blood equals medals. Slaughter is an act of heroism. Oh God, is this the world you created? No human cost was too high to pay to usher in neoliberalism and eviscerate the gains that labor had made under Allende's Popular Unity Coalition, and to maintain a steady flow of cheap copper, fruit, and fish to the U.S. under the auspices of trade liberalization. The new constitution passed under Pinochet's dictatorship rolled back the reforms instituted under Allende. It expanded the power of the presidency and enshrined private property and corporate profits over social needs. Pinochet rolled back taxes on corporations and the wealthy and eliminated a host of government services. State-owned companies, public housing, education, healthcare, and pensions were all privatized, turned into profit centers for corporations and the wealthy. The Constitution written under Pinochet limited reforms, and the gap today between rich and poor in Chile is one of the highest in Latin America. Jara may be technically dead, but if you do a bit of digging around in the internet, you'll see evidence of his long afterlife. Hence the title of a documentary about his impact on musicians in particular, The Resurrection of Victor Jara. Tens of thousands of hands have gone on playing Jara's songs in the nearly 50 years since his torture and murder in the stadium. Jara, says Chilean musician Horacio Salinas in the documentary, could, quote, create a ceremonial effect with his music, unquote. On YouTube, you can find countless videos of musicians playing Jara's songs and songs written in tribute to him, including my personal favorite, Victor Jara's Hands by Joey Burns of the Tucson-based indie rock band Calexico.
Live by a fancy school court,
Wire fences still coiled with flowers of the night. Songs of the birds like hands call the earth to witness. Sever from fear before taking flight. Fences that fail fall to the ground, bearing the fruit from Hara's hands. Over the past few years in particular, as Chileans have pushed to undo the legacy of Pinochet, Hara has been resurrected again and again, the fruit of Hara's hands rising up in songs from the streets and in an all-star Chilean re-recording of Hara's vision of a world without war.
El derecho de vivir sin miedo en nuestro país, en conciencia y unidad con toda la humanidad. Ningún cañón borrará el surco de la hermandad. El derecho de vivir en paz.
At an October 25th, 2019 march in Santiago with the crowd estimated at more than a million, Chileans belted out Hara's anti-war anthem while countless people played along on the guitar, demanding a world in which workers do more than just struggle to survive, one in which everyone has a right to not just bread, but roses, music, and art. The immortal life of Victor Hara and his return to the streets of Santiago amidst the political ferment in Chile of the last few years testifies to the power of art to preserve history, even in the midst of guns, tanks, and bullets bent on wiping it out. To paraphrase the quote Woody Guthrie famously scrawled across his guitar, Hara's songs powerfully illustrate the extent to which we need art to kill fascism, to foster empathy, to remind us of our collective humanity, to preserve in our national memory records of those who stood for justice and those who collaborated to undermine it. We need art to preserve history, to sustain and energize us, to give us courage for the long struggle ahead. This has been Desiree Hollegers for the Old Mulvihill Right, speaking about the immortal life and legacy of Victor Hara.
Thank you, Desiree. Now, Old Mole Matt Witt shares his enthusiasm for a novel alert to the ways class, race, and gender interact in people's lives, in our lives. Here's Matt.
It's not easy to write a novel that tells an engaging story, has the reader identifying with a diverse range of characters, and at the same time shines a light on how race, gender, and class affect people's lives. But that is what the author Kirsten Valdez Quaid has accomplished in her extraordinary new novel called The Five Wounds. The Five Wounds takes place in a small, poor Latinx community in New Mexico and is filled with characters who are facing major challenges in their life. Angel Padilla is a 15-year-old high school student who got pregnant as a result of an encounter she initiated with a boy at a party. She aspires to go to college. She wants a bright future for her baby son. But without resources that more privileged families take for granted, her options are limited. Angel has been living with her 31-year-old mother, who works as an office manager for an insurance company. Both of them want a close relationship, but don't know how. And then Angel has to move out when she is assaulted by the older man her mother is dating. With nowhere else to turn, Angel moves in with her father, Amadeo, who at age 33 is unemployed and drinks too much. Amadeo has not found himself in life and is looking for guidance from his great uncle and other older men in the community. This year, Amadeo has the honor of playing Jesus in the little town's Easter celebration. He's also trying to start a business fixing cracks in people's car windshields. But no matter what he does, he can't shake the feeling of being a screw-up all the time. Amadeo's household that Angel is moving into also includes her grandmother, Amadeo's mother, who works as an administrative assistant in the state legislature and has been the rock of the family, but now finds out she has a brain tumor and has only a few months to live. When Angel is no longer able to attend the regular high school, she starts going to a program for teen mothers that prepares them to get a GED instead. The teacher is an idealistic but inexperienced 25-year-old, trying to connect with her students despite her middle-class background and white privilege. She supplements the academic curriculum with instruction on parenting, life skills, and even meditation, giving Angel a welcome feeling of structure and hope, even as the teacher herself goes through growing pains in her own personal life. At the Teen Mothers program, Angel falls in love with one of the other girls and hopes they will have a deeper relationship than she experienced with any of the boys she knew. But the girl seems headed for a downward spiral as her home life is even more unstable than Angel's. The book's title, The Five Wounds, refers to the five wounds that Jesus suffered on the cross, one nail hole in each hand and foot, and one gash in his side, a physical trauma that Amadeo replicates for the town's Easter observance. But it also refers to the deeper trauma that five generations of the Padilla family inflict on each other and absorb from the unfair and unequal society around them. What makes the novel so special is the author's gift for expressing how each character feels about themselves, about the other characters, and about their place in society. Though the characters are sometimes at odds with each other, the reader ends up rooting for each of them. While the novel is about particular characters in a particular place, anyone can relate to them as they search for connection, for a sense of accomplishment and competence, and for respect for living right and doing good. And while there is no Hollywood ending for any of them, most of them learn and grow as the story progresses, even as the world they live in remains in serious need of social change.
Thanks, Matt, for alerting us to The Five Wounds by Kirsten Valdez Quaid, a novel I plan to read. To conclude our program, I want to recall the March on Washington of 60 years ago. That was the huge demonstration, as I'm sure you know, that featured Martin Luther King Jr.'s I Have a Dream speech. As you probably also know, his most famous line from that speech has been seized upon, distorted, by right-wing forces in this country, ranging from the governor of Florida to the local groups who attack teachers, librarians, and school boards, to argue that any acknowledgement of racism, past or present, is itself racist. When King said, "I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character," he was not saying, "Let's pretend in the here and now that race is not a factor in people's lives." And for many of those who think of themselves as anti-racists, the commemoration shows also how easy it has been to forget King's labor commitments and his anti-imperialism. History is contentious. It doesn't stay history, but is also part of the present. Just as we saw with the coup against Allende, which is being commemorated mainly as an attack on democracy, rather than also as a squelching of one path to socialism, so Martin Luther King Jr. has been tamed in the history books and public celebrations. King grew into a revolutionary, and the March on Washington was for civil rights, but much more. In today's music-filled program, I'd like to play you just a bit of one of my favorite compositions and performances touching on that earlier civil rights struggle. This is John Coltrane's Alabama. You can hear the agony and maybe the hope. Alabama, written and performed by John Coltrane. Thanks to the Old Moles who contributed to today's program. Matt Witt, Desiree Helligers, and Patricia Kohlberg. And to our guest, Christian Araos. Our gratitude with every show we do to the dedicated staff at KBOO. We'll go out with a little more music from Quijarema, also from the album Tinta Verde. This piece called Pachamama. This is Norm Diamond. Till next Monday morning, stay safe, and especially, stay active.